art, a masculine world. The woman watches her manners. She does not dare to irritate, explore, explode. She thinks she has to excuse her literary pretensions by her modesty and good taste. She relies on the proven values of conformism. She introduces just the personal note that is expected of her into her literature. She points out that she is a woman with some well-chosen affectations, simpering and preciosities, so she will excel at producing bestsellers, but she cannot be counted on to blaze new trails. Women do not lack originality in their behavior and feelings. There are some so singular that they have to be locked up. On the whole, many of them are more baroque and eccentric than the men whose strictures they reject. But they put their bizarre genius into their lives, conversation, and correspondence. If they try to write, they feel crushed by the universe of culture because it is a universe of men. They just babble. Inversely, the woman who chooses to reason, to express herself using masculine techniques, will do her best to stifle an originality she distrusts. Like a female student, she will be assiduous and pedantic. She will imitate rigor and virile vigor. She may become an excellent theoretician and acquire a solid talent, but she will make herself repudiate everything in her that is different. There are women who are mad, and there are women of talent. None of them have this madness and talent called genius. This reasonable modesty is what has, above all, defined the limits of feminine talent until now. Many women have eluded, and they increasingly elude, the traps of narcissism and faux wonderment. But no woman has ever thrown prudence to the wind to try to emerge beyond the given world. In the first place, there are, of course, many who accept society just as it is. They are, par excellence, the champions of the bourgeoisie, since they represent the most conservative element of this threatened class. With well-chosen adjectives, they evoke the refinements of a civilization of quality. They extol the bourgeois ideal of happiness and disguise their class interests under the banner of poetry. They orchestrate the mystification intended to persuade women to remain women. Old houses, parks, and kitchen gardens, picturesque grandparents, mischievous children, laundry, jams and jellies, family gatherings, clothes, salons, balls, suffering but exemplary wives, the beauty of devotion and sacrifice, small disappointments and great joys of conjugal love, dreams of youth, mature resignation. Women novelists from England, France, America, Canada, and Scandinavia have exploited these themes to the utmost. They have attained glory and wealth, but have not enriched our vision of the world. Far more interesting are the women insurgents who have indicted this unjust society. Protest literature can give rise to strong and sincere works. George Eliot drew from her revolt a detailed and dramatic vision of Victorian England. However, as Virginia Woolf shows, Jane Austen, the Bronte sisters, and George Eliot had to spend so much negative energy freeing themselves from external constraints that they arrived out of breath at the point where the major masculine writers were starting out. They have little strength left to benefit from their victory and break all the ties that bind them. For example, they lack the irony, the nonchalance of a Stendhal, or his calm sincerity. Nor have they had the wealth of experience of a Dostoevsky, a Tolstoy. It is why the great book Middlemarch does not equal War and Peace. Wuthering Heights, in spite of its stature, does not have the scope of Brothers Karamazov. Today, women already have less trouble asserting themselves, but they have not totally overcome the age-old specification that confines them in their femininity. Lucidity, for example, is a conquest they are justly proud of, but with which they are a little too quickly satisfied. The fact is that the traditional woman is a mystified consciousness and an instrument of mystification. She tries to conceal her dependence from herself, which is a way of consenting to it. To denounce this dependence is already a liberation. Cynicism is a defense against humiliation and shame. It is the first stage of assuming responsibility. In trying to be lucid, Women writers render the greatest service to the cause of women, but without generally realizing it, they remain too attached to serving this cause to adopt, in front of the whole world, the disinterested attitude that opens up wider horizons. When they pull away the veils of illusion and lies, they think they have done enough. Nonetheless, this negative daring still leaves us with an enigma, for truth itself is ambiguity, depth, mystery. After its presence is acknowledged, it must be thought, recreated. It is all well and good not to be duped, but this is where it all begins. The woman exhausts her courage in dissipating mirages, and she stops in fear at the threshold of reality. This is why, for example, there are sincere and endearing women's autobiographies, but none can compare with confessions or memoirs of an egotist. We women are still too preoccupied with seeing clearly to try to penetrate other shadows beyond that clarity. Women never go beyond the pretext, a writer told me. This is true enough. Still amazed at having had permission to explore the world, they take its inventory without trying to discover its meaning. Where they sometimes excel is in the observation of facts. They make remarkable reporters. No male journalist has outdone Andre Violis's eyewitness reports on Indochina and India. They know how to describe atmosphere and people, to show the subtle relations between them, and let us share in the secret workings of their souls. Willa Cather, Edith Wharton, Dorothy Parker, and Catherine Mansfield have sharply and sensitively brought to life individuals, climates, and civilizations. They have rarely succeeded in creating as convincing a masculine hero as Heathcliff. They grasp little more than the male in man, but they often describe their own interior lives, experiences, and universe very well. Attached to the secret side of objects, fascinated by the uniqueness of their own sensations, they convey their fresh experience through the use of savory adjectives and sensual images. Their vocabulary is usually more noticeable than their syntax because they are interested in things more than in their relations. They do not aim for abstract elegance. Instead, their words speak to the senses. One area they have most lovingly explored is nature. For the girl or the woman who has not completely abdicated, nature represents what woman represents for man, herself and her negation, a kingdom and a place of exile. She is all in the guise of the other. The woman writer will most intimately reveal her experience and dreams in speaking of moors or kitchen gardens. There are many who enclose the miracles of sap and seasons in pots, vases, and flower beds. Others, without imprisoning plants and animals, nonetheless try to appropriate them by the attentive love they dispense to them. So it is with Colette and Catherine Mansfield. Very rare are those who approach nature in its inhuman freedom, who try to decipher its foreign meanings and lose themselves in order to unite with this other presence. Hardly any women venture down these roads Rousseau invented, except for Emily Bronte, Virginia Woolf, and sometimes Mary Webb. And to an even greater extent, we can count on the fingers of one hand the women who have traversed the given in search of its secret dimension. Emily Bronte explored death, Virginia Woolf, life, and Catherine Mansfield sometimes, not very often, daily contingents and suffering. No woman ever wrote The Trial, Moby Dick, Ulysses, or Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Women do not challenge the human condition because they have barely begun to be able to assume it entirely. This explains why their works generally lack metaphysical resonance and black humor as well. They do not set the world apart. They do not question it. They do not denounce its contradictions. They take it seriously. The fact is that most men have the same limitations as well. It is when she is compared with the few rare artists who deserve to be called great, that woman comes out as mediocre. Destiny is not what limits her. It is easy to understand why it has not been possible for her to reach the highest summits, and why it will perhaps not be possible for some time. Art, literature, and philosophy are attempts to found the world anew on a human freedom, that of the creator. To foster such an aim, one must first unequivocally posit oneself as a freedom. The restrictions that education and custom impose on woman limit her grasp of the universe. When the struggle to claim a place in this world gets too rough, there can be no question of tearing oneself away from it. One must first emerge within it in sovereign solitude if one wants to try to grasp it anew. What woman primarily lacks is learning from the practice of abandonment and transcendence in anguish and pride. Marie Bashkirtseff writes, "What I want is the freedom to walk around alone, come and go, sit on park benches in the Tuileries gardens. Without this freedom, you cannot become a true artist. You think you can profit from what you see when you are being accompanied or when you must wait for your car, your nursemaid, your family to go to the Louvre. This is the freedom that is missing and without which one cannot seriously become something. Thinking is imprisoned by this stupid and incessant constraint. That is all it takes to clip one's wings. This is one of the reasons there are no women artists." Indeed, for one to become a creator, it is not enough to be cultivated, that is, to make going to shows and meeting people part of one's life. Culture must be apprehended through the free movement of a transcendence. The spirit, with all its riches, must project itself in an empty sky that is its to fill. But if 1,000 fine bonds tie it to the earth, its surge is broken. The girl today can certainly go out alone, stroll in the Tuileries. But I have already said how hostile the street is. Eyes everywhere, hands waiting. If she wanders absent-mindedly, her thoughts elsewhere, if she lights a cigarette in a cafe, if she goes to the cinema alone, an unpleasant incident can quickly occur. She must inspire respect by the way she dresses and behaves. This concern rivets her to the ground and to self. Her wings are clipped. At 18, T.E. Lawrence went on a grand tour through France by bicycle. A young girl would never be permitted to take on such an adventure. Still less would it be possible for her to take off on foot for a half-desert and dangerous country as Lawrence did. Yet such experiences have an inestimable impact. This is how an individual in the headiness of freedom and discovery learns to look at the entire world as his fief. The woman is already naturally deprived of the lessons of violence. I have said how physical weakness disposes her to passivity. When a boy settles a fight with punches, he feels he can rely on himself in his own interest. At least the girl should be allowed to compensate by sports, adventure, and the pride of obstacles overcome. But no, she may feel alone within the world. She never stands up in front of it, unique and sovereign. Everything encourages her to be invested and dominated by foreign existences. And particularly in love, she disavows rather than asserts herself. Misfortune and distress are often learning experiences in this sense. It was isolation that enabled Emily Bronte to write a powerful and unbridled book. In the face of nature, death, and destiny, she relied on no one's help but her own. Rosa Luxemburg was ugly. She was never tempted to wallow in the cult of her image, to make herself object, prey, and trap. From her youth, she was wholly mind and freedom. Even then, it is rare for a woman to fully assume the agonizing tête-à-tête with the given world. The constraints that surround her and the whole tradition that weighs on her keep her from feeling responsible for the universe. This is the profound reason for her mediocrity. Men we call great are those who, in one way or another, take the weight of the world on their shoulders. They have done more or less well. They have succeeded in recreating it, or they have failed. But they took on this enormous burden in the first place. This is what no woman has ever done, what no woman has ever been able to do. It takes belonging to the privileged caste to view the universe as one's own, to consider oneself as guilty of its faults and take pride in its progress. Those alone who are at the controls have the opportunity to justify it by changing, thinking, and revealing it. Only they can identify with it and tried to leave their imprint on it. Until now, it has only been possible for man to be incarnated in the man, not the woman. Moreover, individuals who appear exceptional to us, the ones we honor with the name of genius, are those who tried to work out the fate of all humanity in their particular lives. No woman has thought herself authorized to do that. How could Van Gogh have been born woman? A woman would not have been sent on mission to Borinage. She would not have felt men's misery as her own crime. She would not have sought redemption. So she would never have painted Van Gogh's sunflowers. And this is without taking into account that the painter's kind of life, the solitude in Arles, going to cafes, whorehouses, everything that fed into Van Gogh's art by feeding his sensibility, would have been prohibited to her. A woman could never have become Kafka. In her doubts and anxieties, she would never have recognized the anguish of man driven from paradise. Saint Teresa is one of the only women to have lived the human condition for herself, in total abandonment. We have seen why. Placing herself beyond earthly hierarchies, she, like Saint John of the Cross, felt no reassuring sky over her head. For both of them, it was the same night, the same flashes of light. In each, the same nothingness. In God, the same plenitude. When finally it is possible for every human being to place his pride above sexual differences in the difficult glory of his free existence, only then will woman be able to make her history, her problems, her doubts, and her hopes those of humanity. Only then will she be able to attempt to discover in her life and her works all of reality, and not only her own person. As long as she still has to fight to become a human being, she cannot be a creator. Once again, to explain her limits, we must refer to her situation and not to a mysterious essence. The future remains wide open. The idea that woman has no creative genius has been defended ad nauseam. Madame Marta Borelli, a noted anti-feminist of former times, defends this thesis, among others. But it looks as if she tried to make her books the living proof of incoherence and feminine silliness. And so they contradict themselves. Besides, the idea of a given creative instinct must be rejected, like that of the eternal feminine, and put away in the attic of entities. Some misogynists affirm a bit more concretely that because women are neurotic, they will never create anything of value. But these same people often declare that genius is a neurosis. In any case, the example of Proust shows clearly enough that psychophysiological imbalance does not mean powerlessness or mediocrity. As for the argument drawn from history, we have just seen what we should think of it. The historical past cannot be considered as defining an eternal truth. It merely translates a situation that is showing itself to be historical precisely in that it is in the process of changing. How could women ever have had genius when all possibility of accomplishing a work of genius, or just a work, was refused them? Old Europe formerly heaped its contempt on barbarian Americans for possessing neither artists nor writers. "Let us live before asking us to justify our existence," Jefferson wrote, in essence. Blacks give the same answers to racists who reproach them for not having produced a Whitman or Melville. Neither can the French proletariat invoke a name like Racine or Mallarmé. The free woman is just being born. When she conquers herself, she will perhaps justify Rimbaud's prophecy. Poets will be. When woman's infinite servitude is broken, when she lives for herself and by herself, man, abominable until now, giving her her freedom, she too will be a poet. Woman will find the unknown. Will her worlds of ideas differ from ours? She will find strange, unfathomable, repugnant, delicious things. We will take them. We will understand them. Note, Rimbaud to Paul Demigny, May 15, 1871. Her worlds of ideas are not necessarily different from men's, because she will free herself by assimilating them. To know how singular she will remain and how important these singularities will continue to be, one would have to make some foolhardy predictions. What is beyond doubt is that until now, women's possibilities have been stifled and lost to humanity. And in her and everyone's interest, it is high time she be left to take her own chances. Conclusion. No, woman is not our brother. Through negligence and corruption, we have made her a being apart, unknown, having no weapon but her sex, which is not only perpetual war, but in addition, an unfair weapon. Adoring or hating, but not a frank companion or a being with esprit de corps and Freemasonry, of the eternal little slave's defiances. Many men would still subscribe to these words of Jules Laforgue. Many think that there will always be Sturm und Drang between the two sexes, and that fraternity will never be possible for them. The fact is that neither men nor women are satisfied with each other today. But the question is whether it is an original curse that condemns them to tear each other apart, or whether the conflicts that pit them against each other express a transitory moment in human history. We have seen that in spite of legends, no physiological destiny imposes eternal hostility on the male and female as such. Even the notorious praying mantis devours her male only for lack of other food and for the good of the species. In the animal kingdom, from the top of the ladder to the bottom, all individuals are subordinated to the species. Moreover, humanity is something other than a species. It is a historical becoming. It is defined by the way it assumes natural facticity. Indeed, even with the greatest bad faith in the world, it is impossible to detect a rivalry between the male and the female human that is specifically physiological. And so their hostility is located on that ground that is intermediate between biology and psychology, namely psychoanalysis. Woman, it is said, envies man's penis and desires to castrate him. But the infantile desire for the penis only has importance in the adult woman's life if she experiences her femininity as a mutilation. And it is only to the extent that the penis embodies all the privileges of virility that she wishes to appropriate the male organ for herself. It is generally agreed that her dream of castration has a symbolic significance. She wishes, so it is thought, to deprive the male of his transcendence. Her wish, as we have seen, is much more ambiguous. She wishes, in a contradictory way, to have this transcendence, which presupposes that she both respects and denies it, and that she intends both to throw herself into it and to keep it within herself. This is to say that the drama does not unfold on a sexual level. Sexuality, moreover, has never seemed to us to define a destiny or to provide in itself the key to human behavior, but to express the totality of a situation it helps define. The battle of the sexes is not immediately implied by the anatomy of man and woman. In fact, when it is mentioned, it is taken for granted that in the timeless heaven of ideas, a battle rages between these uncertain essences, the eternal feminine and the eternal masculine. And it is not noticed that this titanic combat assumes two totally different forms on Earth, corresponding to different historical moments. The woman, confined to immanence, tries to keep man in this prison as well. Thus, the prison will merge with the world, and she will no longer suffer from being shut up in it. The mother, the wife, the lover are the jailers. Society, codified by men, decrees that woman is inferior. She can only abolish this inferiority by destroying male superiority. She does her utmost to mutilate, to dominate man. She contradicts him. She denies his truth and values. But in doing that, she is only defending herself. Neither immutable essence nor flawed choice has doomed her to immanence and inferiority. They were imposed on her. All oppression creates a state of war. This particular case is no exception. The existent, considered as inessential, cannot fail to attempt to reestablish his sovereignty. Today, the combat is taking another form. Instead of wanting to put man in prison, woman is trying to escape from it. She no longer seeks to drag him into the realms of immanence, but to emerge into the light of transcendence. And the male attitude here creates a new conflict. The man petulantly dumps the woman. He is pleased to remain the sovereign subject, the absolute superior, the essential being. He refuses to consider his companion concretely as an equal. She responds to his defiance by an aggressive attitude. It is no longer a war between individuals imprisoned in their respective spheres. A caste claiming its rights lays siege, but is held in check by the privileged caste. Two transcendences confront each other. Instead of mutually recognizing each other, each freedom wants to dominate the other. This difference in attitude is manifest on the sexual as well as the spiritual level. The feminine woman, by becoming a passive prey, tries to reduce the male to carnal passivity as well. She works at entrapping him, at imprisoning him, by the desire she arouses, docilely making herself a thing. The emancipated woman, on the contrary, wants to be active and prehensile, and refuses the passivity the man attempts to impose on her. Likewise, Elise and her followers do not accord any value to virile activities. Note, Bold Chronicle of a Strange Marriage, translation. They place flesh above spirit, contingence above freedom, conventional wisdom above creative daring. But the modern woman accepts masculine values. She prides herself on thinking, acting, working, and creating on the same basis as males. Instead of trying to belittle them, she declares herself their equal. This claim is legitimate insofar as it is expressed in concrete ways, and it is men's insolence that is then reprehensible. But in their defense, it must be said that women themselves tend to confuse the issue. A Mabel Dodge attempted to enslave Lawrence by her feminine wiles in order to then dominate him spiritually. To show by their successes that they equal a man, many women strive to secure masculine support through sex. They play both sides, demanding both old-fashioned respect and modern esteem, relying on their old magic and their fledgling rights. It is understandable that the irritated man should go on the defensive. But he, too, is duplicitous when he demands that the woman play the game loyally, whereas he, in his hostility and distrust, refuses to grant her indispensable trump cards. In reality, the struggle between them cannot be clear-cut, since woman's very being is opacity. She does not stand in front of man as a subject, but as an object paradoxically endowed with subjectivity. She assumes herself as both self and other, which is a contradiction with disconcerting consequences. When she makes a weapon of both her weakness and her strength, it is not a deliberate calculation. She is spontaneously seeking her salvation in the path imposed on her, that of passivity, at the same time as she is actively demanding her sovereignty. And this process is undoubtedly not fair play. But it is dictated by the ambiguous situation assigned to her. Man, though, when he treats her like a freedom, is indignant that she is still a trap for him. While he flatters and satisfies her in her role as his prey, he gets annoyed at her claims to autonomy. Whatever he does, he feels duped, and she feels wronged. The conflict will last as long as men and women do not recognize each other as peers, that is, as long as femininity is perpetuated as such. Which of them is the most determined to maintain it? The woman who frees herself from it nevertheless wants to conserve its prerogatives. And the man then demands that she assume its limitations. It is easier to accuse one sex than to excuse the other, says Montaigne. Meeting out blame and approbation is useless. In fact, the vicious circle is so difficult to break here because each sex is victim both of the other and of itself. Between two adversaries confronting each other in their pure freedom, an agreement could easily be found, especially as this war does not benefit anyone. But the complexity of this whole business comes from the fact that each camp is its enemy's accomplice. The woman pursues a dream of resignation, the man a dream of alienation. Inauthenticity does not pay. Each one blames the other for the unhappiness brought on himself by taking the easy way out. What the man and the woman hate in each other is the striking failure of their own bad faith or their own cowardice. We have seen why men originally enslaved women. The devaluation of femininity was a necessary step in human development. But this step could have brought about a collaboration between the two sexes. Oppression is explained by the tendency of the existent to flee from himself by alienating himself and the other that he oppresses for that purpose. This tendency can be found in each individual man today, and the vast majority give into it. A husband looks for himself in his wife, a lover in his mistress, in the guise of a stone statue. He seeks in her the myth of his virility, his sovereignty, his unmediated reality. "My husband never goes to the movies," says the woman, and the dubious masculine pronouncement is engraved in the marble of eternity. But he himself is a slave to his double. What effort to build up an image in which he is always in danger. After all, it is founded on the capricious freedom of women. It must constantly be made favorable. Man is consumed by the concern to appear male, important, superior. He play-acts so that others will play-act with him. He is also aggressive and nervous. He feels hostility for women because he is afraid of them. And he is afraid of them because he is afraid of the character with whom he is assimilated. What time and energy he wastes in getting rid of, idealizing and transposing complexes, in speaking about women, seducing and fearing them. He would be liberated with their liberation. But that is exactly what he fears. And he persists in the mystifications meant to maintain woman in her chains. That she is mystified is something of which many men are conscious. What a curse to be a woman. And yet the very worst curse when one is a woman is, in fact, not to understand that it is one, says Kierkegaard. Note, in Vino Veritas, he also says, gallantry is essentially woman's due, and the fact that she unconsciously accepts it may be explained by the solicitude of nature for the weak and the disadvantaged, those who feel more than recompensed by an illusion. But this illusion is precisely fatal. Is it not an even worse mockery to feel freed from misery, thanks to one's imagination, to be the dupe of imagination? Woman certainly is far from being verwahrlost, abandoned. But inasmuch as she never can free herself from the illusion with which nature consoles her, she is. Attempts have been made to disguise this misfortune for a long time. Guardianship, for example, was eliminated. The woman was given protectors. And if they were endowed with the rights of the old guardians, it was in her best interest. Forbidding her to work and keeping her at home is intended to defend her against herself and ensure her happiness. We have seen the poetic veils used to hide the monotonous burdens she bears, housework and maternity. In exchange for her freedom, she was given fallacious treasures of femininity as a gift. Balzac described this maneuver very well in advising a man to treat her as a slave while persuading her she is a queen. Less cynical, many men endeavor to convince themselves she is truly privileged. There are American sociologists seriously teaching today the theory of low-class gain, that is, the advantages of the lower castes. In France as well, it has often been proclaimed, albeit less scientifically, that workers are indeed lucky not to be obliged to present well, and even more so tramps who could dress in rags and sleep on the streets, pleasures that were forbidden to the Comte de Beaumont and those poor Wandel gentlemen. Like the filthy carefree souls cheerfully scratching their vermin, like the joyful Negroes laughing while being lashed, and like these gay Arabs of Seuss with a smile on their lips, burying their children who starved to death, the woman enjoys this incomparable privilege, irresponsibility. Without difficulties, without responsibility, without cares, She obviously has the best part. What is troubling is that by a stubborn perversity, undoubtedly linked to original sin, across centuries and countries, the people who have the best part always shout to their benefactors, "It's too much. I'll settle for yours." But the magnanimous capitalists, the generous colonialists, the superb males persist. Keep the best part. Keep it. The fact is that men encounter more complicity in their woman companions than the oppressor usually finds in the oppressed. And in bad faith, they use it as a pretext to declare that woman wanted the destiny they imposed on her. We have seen that in reality, her whole education conspires to bar her from paths of revolt and adventure. All of society, beginning with her respected parents, lies to her in extolling the high value of love, devotion, and the gift of self, and in concealing the fact that neither lover, husband, nor children will be disposed to bear the burdensome responsibility of it. She cheerfully accepts these lies because they invite her to take the easy slope, and that is the worst of the crimes committed against her. From her childhood and throughout her life, she is spoiled. She is corrupted by the fact that this resignation, tempting to any existent anxious about her freedom, is meant to be her vocation. If one encourages a child to be lazy by entertaining him all day, without giving him the occasion to study, without showing him its value, no one will say when he reaches the age of man that he chose to be incapable and ignorant. This is how the woman is raised. Without ever being taught the necessity of assuming her own existence, she readily lets herself count on the protection, love, help, and guidance of others. She lets herself be fascinated by the hope of being able to realize her being without doing anything. She is wrong to yield to this temptation, but the man is ill-advised to reproach her for it, since it is he himself who tempted her. When a conflict breaks out between them, each one will blame the other for the situation. She will blame him for creating it. "No one taught me to reason, to earn my living." He will blame her for accepting it. "You know nothing. You are incompetent." Each sex thinks it can justify itself by taking the offensive. But the wrongs of one do not absolve the other. The innumerable conflicts that set men and women against each other stem from the fact that neither sex assumes all the consequences of the situation that one proposes and the other undergoes. This problematic notion of equality in inequality that one uses to hide his despotism and the other her cowardice does not withstand the test of experience. In their exchanges, woman counts on the abstract equality she was guaranteed, and man the concrete inequality he observes. From there ensues the endless debate on the ambiguity of the words give and take in all relationships. She complains of giving everything. He protests that she takes everything from him. The woman has to understand that an exchange, a basic law of political economy, is negotiated according to the value the proposed merchandise has for the buyer and not for the seller. She was duped by being persuaded she was priceless. In reality, she is merely a distraction, a pleasure, company, an inessential article for the man. For her, he is the meaning, the justification of her existence. The two objects exchanged are thus not of the same quality. This inequality will be particularly noticeable because the time they spend together, and that fallaciously seems to be the same time, does not have the same value for both partners. During the evening the lover spends with his mistress, he might be doing something useful for his career, seeing friends, cultivating relations, entertaining himself. For a man, normally integrated into society, time is a positive asset, money, reputation, pleasure. By contrast, for the idle and bored woman, time is a burden she aspires to get rid of. She considers it a benefit to succeed in killing time. The man's presence is pure profit. In many cases, what interests man the most in a relationship is the sexual gain he draws from it. He can, at worst, settle for spending just enough time with his mistress to perform the sex act, but what she herself wants, with rare exceptions, is to dispose of all this excess time she has on her hands. And, like the shopkeeper who will not sell his potatoes if one does not take his turnips, she only gives her body if the lover takes hours of conversation and outings into the bargain. Balance can be established if the cost of the whole matter does not seem too high to the man. That depends, of course, on how intense is his desire and how important to him the occupations he sacrifices. But if the woman demands, offers, too much time, she becomes completely importunate, like the river that overflows its banks, and the man will choose to have nothing rather than to have too much. So she moderates her demands. But very often a balance is found at the price of a twofold tension. She believes that the man has her at a bargain price. He thinks he is paying too much. Of course, this explanation is somewhat humorous, but except in cases of jealous and exclusive passion where the man wants the woman in her entirety, this conflict in tenderness, desire, even love, is always present. The man always has something else to do with his time, whereas she is trying to get rid of hers, and he does not consider the hours she devotes to him as a gift, but as a burden. Generally, he consents to tolerate it because he knows he is on the privileged side. He has a guilty conscience, and if he has any goodwill, he tries to compensate for the unequal conditions with generosity. However, he gives himself credit for being compassionate, and at the first clash, he treats the woman as ungrateful. He gets irritated. "I am too generous." She feels she is acting like a beggar, while she is convinced of the high value of her gifts, and this humiliates her. This explains the cruelty of which the woman often shows herself capable. She feels self-righteous because she has the bad role. She does not feel any obligation to accommodate the privileged caste. She thinks only of defending herself. She will even be very happy if she has the opportunity to display her resentment to the lover who has not been able to satisfy her. Since he does not give enough, she will take everything back with fierce pleasure. Then the wounded man discovers the total price of the relationship, whose every minute he disdained. He agrees to all the promises, even if it means he will again consider himself exploited when he has to honor them. He accuses his mistress of blackmailing him. She blames him for his stinginess. Both consider themselves frustrated. Here, too, it is useless to allocate excuses and criticism. Justice can never be created within injustice. It is impossible for a colonial administrator to conduct himself well with the indigenous population, or a general with his soldiers. The only solution is to be neither colonialist nor military leader. But a man cannot prevent himself from being a man. So here he is, thus guilty in spite of himself, and oppressed by this fault that he has not committed himself. Likewise, she is a victim and a shrew in spite of herself. Sometimes he revolts. He chooses cruelty. But then he makes himself an accomplice of injustice, and the fault really becomes his. Sometimes he allows himself to be destroyed, devoured, by his protesting victim. But then he feels duped. Often he settles for a compromise that both diminishes him and puts him ill at ease. A man of goodwill will be more torn by the situation than the woman herself. In one sense, one is always better off being on the side of the defeated. But if she is also of goodwill, unable to be self-sufficient, unwilling to crush the man with the weight of her destiny, she struggles with herself in an inextricable confusion. One meets so many of these cases in daily life for which there are no satisfactory solutions because they are defined by unsatisfactory conditions. A man who sees himself as obligated to maintain a woman he no longer loves materially and morally feels he is a victim. But if he abandoned, without resources, the one who has committed her whole life to him, she would be a victim in an equally unjust manner. The wrong does not come from individual perversity, and bad faith arises when each person attacks the other. It comes from a situation in the face of which all individual behavior is powerless. Women are clingy, they are a burden, and they suffer from it. Their lot is that of a parasite that sucks the life from a foreign organism. Were they endowed with an autonomous organism, were they able to fight against the world and wrest their subsistence from it, their dependence would be abolished, the man's also. Both would undoubtedly be much better off for it. A world where men and women would be equal is easy to imagine because it is exactly the one the Soviet Revolution promised. Women raised and educated exactly like men would work under the same conditions and for the same salaries. Note, that some arduous professions are prohibited to them does not contradict this idea. Even men are seeking professional training more and more. Their physical and intellectual capacities limit their choices. In any case, what is demanded is that no boundaries of sex or caste be drawn. Erotic freedom would be accepted by custom, but the sexual act would no longer be considered a remunerable service. Women would be obliged to provide another livelihood for themselves. Marriage would be based on a free engagement that the spouses could break when they wanted to. Motherhood would be freely chosen, that is, birth control and abortion would be allowed. And in return, all mothers and their children would be given the same rights. Maternity leave would be paid for by the society that would have responsibility for the children, which does not mean that they would be taken from their parents, but that they would not be abandoned to them. But is it enough to change laws, institutions, customs, public opinion, and the whole social context for men and women to really become peers? Women will always be women, say the skeptics. Other seers prophesy that in shedding their femininity, they will not succeed in changing into men and will become monsters. This would mean that today's woman is nature's creation. It must be repeated again that within the human collectivity, nothing is natural, and woman, among others, is a product developed by civilization. The intervention of others in her destiny is originary. If this process were driven in another way, it would produce a very different result. Woman is defined neither by her hormones nor by mysterious instincts, but by the way she grasps, through foreign consciousnesses, her body and her relation to the world. The abyss that separates adolescent girls from adolescent boys was purposely dug out from early infancy. Later, it would be impossible to keep woman from being what she was made, and she will always trail this past behind her. If the weight of this past is accurately measured, it is obvious that her destiny is not fixed in eternity. One must certainly not think that modifying her economic situation is enough to transform woman. This factor has been and remains the primordial factor of her development. But until it brings about the moral, social, and cultural consequences it heralds and requires, the new woman cannot appear. As of now, these consequences have been realized nowhere. In the USSR, no more than in France or the United States. And this is why today's woman is torn between the past and the present. Most often she appears as a real woman disguised as a man, and she feels as awkward in her woman's body as in her masculine garb. She has to shed her old skin and cut her own clothes. She will only be able to do this if there is a collective change. No one teacher can today shape a female human being. That would be an exact homologue to the male human being. If raised like a boy, the young girl feels she is an exception, and that subjects her to a new kind of specification. Stendhal understood this, saying, "The forest must be planted all at once." But if we suppose, by contrast, a society where sexual equality is concretely realized, this equality would newly assert itself in each individual. If, from the earliest age, the little girl were raised with the same demands and honors, the same severity and freedom as her brothers, taking part in the same studies and games, promised the same future, surrounded by women and men who are unambiguously equal to her, the meanings of the castration complex and the Oedipus complex would be profoundly modified. The mother would enjoy the same lasting prestige as the father if she assumed equal material and moral responsibility for the couple. The child would feel an androgynous world around her and not a masculine world. Were she more effectively attracted to her father, which is not even certain, Her love for him would be nuanced by a will to emulate him, and not a feeling of weakness. She would not turn to passivity if she were allowed to prove her worth in work and sports, actively rivaling boys. The absence of a penis, compensated for by the promise of a child, would not suffice to cause an inferiority complex. Correlatively, the boy would not have a natural superiority complex if it were not instilled in him and if he held women in the same esteem as men. Note: I know a little boy of 8 who lives with a mother, aunt, and grandmother, all 3 independent and active, and a grandfather who is half senile. He has a crushing inferiority complex in relation to the female sex, though his mother tries to combat it. In his lycée, he scorns his friends and professors because they are poor males. The little girl would not seek sterile compensations in narcissism and dreams. She would not take herself as given. She would be interested in what she does. She would throw herself into her pursuits. I have said how much easier puberty would be if she surpassed it, like the boy, toward a free adult future. Menstruation horrifies her only because it signifies a brutal descent into femininity. She would also assume her youthful eroticism more peacefully if she did not feel a frightening disgust for the rest of her destiny. A coherent sexual education would greatly help her to surmount this crisis. And thanks to coeducation, the august mystery of man would have no occasion to arise. It would be killed by everyday familiarity and open competition. Objections to this system always imply respect for sexual taboos, but it is useless to try to inhibit curiosity and pleasure in children. This only results in creating repression, obsessions, and neuroses. Exalted sentimentality, homosexual fervor, and the platonic passions of adolescent girls, along with the whole procession of nonsense and dissipation, are far more harmful than a few childish games and actual experiences. What would really be profitable for the young girl is that, not seeking in the male a demigod, but only a pal, a friend, a partner, she not be diverted from assuming her own existence. Eroticism and love would be a free surpassing and not a resignation. She could experience them in a relationship of equal to equal. Of course, there is no question of writing off all the difficulties a child must overcome to become an adult. The most intelligent, tolerant education could not free her from having her own experiences at her own expense. What one would want is that obstacles should not accumulate gratuitously on her path. It is already an improvement that depraved little girls are no longer cauterized with red-hot irons. Psychoanalysis has enlightened parents somewhat, yet the conditions in which women's sexual education and initiation take place today are so deplorable that none of the objections to the idea of a radical change are valid. It is not a question of abolishing the contingencies and miseries of the human condition in her, but of giving her the means to go beyond them. Woman is the victim of no mysterious fate. The singularities that make her different derive their importance from the meaning applied to them. They can be overcome as soon as they are grasped from new perspectives. We have seen that in her erotic experience, the woman feels and often detests male domination. It must not be concluded that her ovaries condemn her to living on her knees eternally. Virile aggressiveness is a lordly privilege only within a system where everything conspires to affirm masculine sovereignty. And woman feels so deeply passive in the love act only because she already thinks herself that way. Many modern women who claim their dignity as human beings still grasp their sexual lives by referring back to a tradition of slavery. So it seems humiliating to them to lie under the man and be penetrated by him, and they tense up into frigidity. But if reality were different, the meaning sexual gestures and postures symbolically express would be different as well. A woman who pays, who dominates her lover, can, for example, feel proud of her superb inertia and think that she is enslaving the male who is actively exerting himself. And today, there are already many sexually balanced couples for whom notions of victory and defeat yield to an idea of exchange. In fact, man is, like woman, a flesh, thus a passivity, the plaything of his hormones and the species, uneasy prey to his desire. And she, like him, in the heart of carnal fervor, is consent, voluntary gift, and activity. Each of them lives the strange ambiguity of existence made body in his or her own way. In these combats where they believe they are tackling each other, they are fighting their own self, projecting onto their partner the part of themselves they repudiate. Instead of living the ambiguity of their condition, each one tries to make the other accept the abjection of this condition and reserves the honor of it for oneself. If, however, both assumed it with lucid modesty, as the correlate of authentic pride, they would recognize each other as peers and live the erotic drama in harmony. The fact of being a human being is infinitely more important than all the singularities that distinguish human beings. It is never the given that confers superiority. Virtue, as the ancients called it, is defined at the level of what depends on us. The same drama of flesh and spirit, and of finitude and transcendence, plays itself out in both sexes. Both are eaten away by time, stalked by death. They have the same essential need of the other, and they can take the same glory from their freedom. If they knew how to savor it, they would no longer be tempted to contend for false privileges, and fraternity could then be born between them. People will say that all these considerations are merely utopian because to remake woman, society would have had to have already made her really man's equal. Conservatives have never missed the chance to denounce this vicious circle in all analogous circumstances. Yet history does not go round in circles. Without a doubt, if a caste is maintained in an inferior position, it remains inferior. But freedom can break the circle. Let blacks vote and they become worthy of the vote. Give woman responsibilities and she knows how to assume them. The fact is, one would not think of expecting gratuitous generosity from oppressors. But the revolt of the oppressed at times and changes in the privileged caste at other times create new situations. And this is how men, in their own interest, have been led to partially emancipate women. Women need only pursue their rise, and the success they obtain encourages them. It seems most certain that they will sooner or later attain perfect economic and social equality, which will bring about an inner metamorphosis. In any case, some will object that if such a world is possible, it is not desirable. When woman is the same as her male, life will lose its spice. This argument is not new either. Those who have an interest in perpetuating the present always shed tears for the marvelous past about to disappear without casting a smile on the young future. It is true that by doing away with slave markets, we destroyed those great plantations lined with azaleas and camellias. We dismantled the whole delicate southern civilization. Old lace was put away in the attics of time along with the pure timbres of the Sistine Castrati, and there is a certain feminine charm that risks turning to dust as well. I grant that only a barbarian would not appreciate rare flowers, lace, the crystal clear voice of a eunuch, or feminine charm. When shown in her splendor, the charming woman is a far more exalting object than the idiotic paintings, overdoors, decors, circus backdrops, sideboards, or popular illuminations that maddened Rimbaud. Adorned with the most modern of artifices, worked on with the newest techniques, she comes from the remotest ages, from Thebes, Minos, Chichen Itza, and she is also the totem planted in the heart of the African jungle. She is a helicopter, and she is a bird, and here is the greatest wonder. Beneath her painted hair, the rustling of leaves becomes a thought, and words escape from her breasts. Men reach out their eager hands to the marvel, but as soon as they grasp it, it vanishes. The wife and the mistress speak like everyone else, with their mouths. Their words are worth exactly what they are worth, their breasts as well. Does such a fleeting miracle, and one so rare, justify perpetuating a situation that is so damaging for both sexes? The beauty of flowers and women's charms can be appreciated for what they are worth. If these treasures are paid for with blood or misery, one must be willing to sacrifice them. The fact is that this sacrifice appears particularly heavy to men. Few of them really wish in their hearts to see women accomplish themselves. Those who scorn woman do not see what they would have to gain, and those who cherish her see too well what they have to lose. And it is true that present-day developments not only threaten feminine charm. In deciding to live for herself, woman will abdicate the functions as double and mediator that provide her with her privileged place within the masculine universe. For the man caught between the silence of nature and the demanding presence of other freedoms, a being who is both his peer and a passive thing appears as a great treasure. He may well perceive his companion in a mythical form, but the experiences of which she is the source or pretext are no less real. And there are hardly more precious, intimate, or urgent ones. It cannot be denied that feminine dependence, inferiority, and misfortune give women their unique character. Assuredly, women's autonomy, even if it spares men a good number of problems, will also deny them many conveniences. Assuredly, there are certain ways of living the sexual adventure that will be lost in the world of tomorrow. But this does not mean that love, happiness, poetry, and dreams will be banished from it. Let us beware lest our lack of imagination impoverish the future. The future is only an abstraction for us. Each of us secretly laments the absence in it of what was. But tomorrow's humankind will live the future in its flesh and in its freedom. That future will be its present, and humankind will in turn prefer it. New carnal and affective relations of which we cannot conceive will be born between the sexes. Friendships, rivalries, complicities, chaste or sexual companionships that past centuries would not have dreamed of are already appearing. For example, nothing seems more questionable to me than a catchphrase that dooms the new world to uniformity and then to boredom. I do not see an absence of boredom in this world of ours, nor that freedom has ever created uniformity. First of all, certain differences between man and woman will always exist. Her eroticism, and thus her sexual world, possessing a singular form, cannot fail to engender in her a sensuality, a singular sensitivity. Her relation to her body, to the male body, and to the child, will never be the same as those man has with his body, with the female body, and with the child. Those who talk so much about equality in difference would be hard put not to grant me that there are differences in equality. Besides, it is institutions that create monotony. Young and pretty, slaves of the harem, are all the same in the Sultan's arms. Christianity gave eroticism its flavor of sin and legend by endowing the human female with a soul. Restoring woman's singular sovereignty will not remove the emotional value from amorous embraces. It is absurd to contend that orgies, vice, ecstasy, and passion would become impossible if man and woman were concretely peers. The contradictions opposing flesh to spirit, instant to time, the vertigo of immanence to the appeal of transcendence, the absolute of pleasure to the nothingness of oblivion will never disappear. Tension, suffering, joy, and the failure and triumph of existence will always be materialized in sexuality. To emancipate woman is to refuse to enclose her in the relations she sustains with man, but not to deny them. While she posits herself for herself, she will nonetheless continue to exist for him as well. Recognizing each other as subject, each will remain an other for the other. Reciprocity in their relations will not do away with the miracles that the division of human beings into two separate categories engenders. Desire, possession, love, dreams, adventure, and the words that move us, to give, to conquer, and to unite, will keep their meaning. On the contrary, it is when the slavery of half of humanity is abolished, and with it, the whole hypocritical system it implies, that the division of humanity will reveal its authentic meaning and the human couple will discover its true form. The direct, natural, and necessary relation of person to person is the relation of man to woman, said Marx. Note, Philosophical Works, Volume 6. Marx and Engels, Collected Works, Volume 6. Translation. From the character of this relationship follows how much man as a species being, as man, has come to be himself and to comprehend himself. The relation of man to woman is the most natural relation of human being to human being. It therefore reveals the extent to which man's natural behavior has become human, or the extent to which the human essence in him has become a natural essence. The extent to which his human nature has come to be natural to him. This could not be better said. Within the given world, it is up to man to make the reign of freedom triumph. To carry off this supreme victory, men and women must, among other things, and beyond their natural differentiations, unequivocally affirm their brotherhood. This is Ellen Archer. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir, translated by Constance Board and Sheila Malovany Chevalier, with an introduction by Judith Thurman. This program was directed by Barbara Vlahidis, executive producer Linda Korn. Originally published in two volumes as Le Dixième Sexe, Les Faits et les Mythes, Volume 1, and L'Expérience Vécue, Volume 2. Copyright 1949 by Édition Gallimard, Paris. Translation copyright 2019 by Constance Board and Sheila Malovany Chevalier. Introduction copyright 2009 by Judith Thurman. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.